Hi, welcome to the Growth.me summary for the book Persuasion by Robert Cialdini. Persuasion shows a new side of influence. It's about everything that happens before you ask someone to say yes to your proposal. Professor Robert Cialdini has distilled hundreds of scientific studies to prove that how we frame a message from the beginning is crucial to its success. Our top quote from this book is, "What we present first changes the way people experience what we present to them next," end quote. So who is Dr. Robert Cialdini? Well, he's considered by many to be the world's top expert on the psychology of influence. He wrote an incredible book called Influence in 1984, which has become a classic. Many great business people still consider that one to be one of the best marketing books ever, including the billionaire Charlie Munger, who is Warren Buffett's business partner and one of the richest people in the world. And our summary of that book will be coming soon, too. So Robert Cialdini was a professor at Arizona State University for many years and guest lecturer at Stanford and other universities. And because he is an academic, he grounds his ideas in a lot of scientific studies as much as possible. So now let's learn some of the best lessons from his newest book, which is called Persuasion, starting with lesson one. Make people receptive to your message before they hear it with persuasion. The ancient war general Sun Tzu said that every battle is won before it is fought. And so we all fight many small battles in our lives, battles when we need to persuade someone to our way of thinking. Maybe you want to convince an important person to work on your business project. Maybe you want agreement with your partner on how to raise your kids. Maybe you want more people paying attention to your marketing so you can grow your business. Well, good news. This book promises to help us do all of these things more easily. Let's begin by clarifying the difference between regular persuasion and what Cialdini is calling persuasion. So most people know that persuasion means getting someone to say yes or to agree, getting them to sign that contract or agree to your way of thinking. But what does persuasion mean? I'll let Professor Cialdini tell you in his own words from the book. Here's a quote. Persuasion, the process of arranging for recipients to be receptive to a message before they encounter it, end quote. You see, Cialdini spent many years studying top salespeople, negotiators, marketers, and public relations experts. And after careful study, he noticed something all the top achieving professionals in those fields had in common. Here's another quote. The highest achievers spent more time crafting what they did and said before making a request. They didn't rely on the legitimate merits of an offer to get it accepted. They recognized that the psychological frame in which an appeal is first placed can carry equal or even greater weight, end quote. So, persuasion is everything you do before making a request from someone. You see, there are practical ways of making people more receptive to your proposals before you make the request, offer, or proposal. And that means they will be more willing to say yes to you. Obviously, this knowledge could be very useful for many of our careers or businesses. Here's an example. Cialdini, he had a colleague who was doing very expensive consulting work for large companies, and his colleague often complained to Cialdini that these companies were always trying to make him lower his fees. But one day, he stumbled on a technique that made the company stop arguing about his prices. Here's a quote. After his standard presentation and just before declaring his $75,000 fee, he joked, "As you can tell, I'm not going to be able to charge you $1 million for this," end quote. And when he made that joke the one time, he noticed the company did not challenge his actual fee later. So he thought, you know, maybe I should try telling this joke on purpose all the time. So that's what he did. After his other future sales presentations, he did the joke again, and then he quoted his fee, and he noticed the other companies now didn't argue about the fee, Well, that's pretty weird, isn't it? Well, what Cialdini's colleague accidentally discovered was that mentioning $1 million, even as a joke, made companies stop complaining about his real price. Why? Well, because even thinking about $1 million first, that later makes $75,000 feel cheap by comparison. Here's another quote. My colleague claims that this tactic of mentioning an admittedly unrealistic price tag for a job doesn't always win the business. There's too many other factors involved for that. But it almost always eliminates challenges to the charges. End quote. This trick is actually called price anchoring. And although most people don't know about this trick, and Cialdini's colleague discovered it by accident almost, the smartest marketers use this trick all the time. For example, Steve Jobs often used price anchoring in his presentations of new products. When he was announcing the first iPad, he first showed a price of $999 on the big screen behind him. And he said, $1,000 was the price most people expected to pay for this brand new device. But then, after a few minutes, he revealed the real price, which was $499, and many people in the audience began cheering. $499, although it's a lot of money, well, it suddenly felt really cheap in comparison to the first price shown. Another way of price anchoring is to show customers your most expensive product first. So afterwards, the less expensive products suddenly feel like a great value. Salespeople are often trained to do this. For example, a $500,000 house can feel very expensive, but if the real estate agent has just shown you a few million-dollar homes, well, then suddenly it feels very reasonable. Price anchoring is just one example of ways that we can set up a certain psychological frame in people's minds. Notice that none of those techniques we just mentioned involved arguing with people that the price is fair. Instead, when you put a large price in a customer's mind at the beginning, it automatically makes the real price feel small by comparison. So, what you do before you show the price to your customers can have a huge impact on how they perceive your real price. And this has just been a couple examples to demonstrate the power of persuasion. So, a summary of this first lesson. There are ways to make people more open or willing to say yes to your request, offer, or proposal. For example, mentioning a high price in the beginning can later make your real price feel much cheaper by comparison, reducing price resistance. And now we have lesson two. Pay attention to something, and it will automatically seem more important to you. Daniel Kahneman was a professor of psychology at Stanford University, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. He's written some very smart books, and he deeply understands how human behavior works. So a few years ago, someone asked him, "How could regular people like you and me make better decisions for ourselves?" And he said the biggest idea is this, quote, "Nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it," end quote. Remember, this is one of the world's smartest people in psychology, human behavior, and economics, and he is saying that, quote, "Nothing in life is as important as you think it is while you are thinking about it," end quote. Well, here's an example of what this means from Cialdini's book. Most of us believe if we suddenly couldn't use our legs anymore, then we would be miserable forever. Yet, when you look at the scientific studies, well, paraplegics are about as happy as the average person. You see, right now, when we think about being a paraplegic, we are focusing on the one big negative of it, which is not being able to use our legs anymore. And this thought makes most of us feel terrible. Yet, real paraplegics are not thinking about their disability most of the time. Most of the time, they're focused on other things like their work, a hobby, TV show, or having a conversation with a friend. It's the same things the rest of us are generally focused on. So there's a big lesson here. When your attention becomes narrow, then you overestimate the importance of that one thing you're paying attention to. In short, attention equals importance. Let's talk about one way the mainstream media takes advantage of this idea. Have you ever heard of something called agenda-setting theory? Here's how Cialdini describes it in the book. Quote, "The central tenet of agenda-setting theory is that the media rarely produces change directly by presenting compelling evidence that sweeps an audience to new positions. They are much more likely to persuade indirectly by giving selected issues and facts better coverage than other issues and facts." End quote. So, the experts believe that the news and media usually can't change people's minds directly using new facts or evidence or arguments. And I'm sure if you ever talk to someone about politics who is very left or right wing, then I'm sure you already know how true this is. But what the media can do, what they have the power to do, is change what issues are getting the most attention. They can at least control what is being talked about more. And so if an issue is being given a lot of attention and coverage daily, then people start to automatically assume that it's most important. And the other issues sort of fade into the background and are forgotten. What this also means is that being able to capture, direct, and hold people's attention is very important to persuading them. So the next few lessons will be all about attention. Summary of this lesson too is, attention equals importance. We overestimate the importance of whatever we are paying attention to at this moment. Through agenda-setting theory, the news and other media know they can influence the public not by changing our minds, but by directing our attention to certain issues and not others. Now lesson three. Direct someone's attention in a new direction and they will forget previous concerns. Usually, we try to persuade people by arguing with them, convincing them, or giving them reasons. But that is actually the hardest way to change someone's mind. It's a lot easier to change what someone is paying attention to. If you can change what direction they are focusing in right now, then you can often change their decisions, at least in this moment. This is so important because our attention is naturally limited. We can only really pay attention to one thing at a time. So when something new grabs our attention, then we must immediately let go of thinking about other things. Here's what Professor Cialdini says about this. Quote, "We are said to pay attention. And when attention is paid to something, the price is attention lost to something else. Indeed, because the human mind appears able to hold only one thing in conscious awareness at a time, the toll is a momentary loss of focused attention to everything else." End quote. For example, when Donald Trump is asked a difficult question, one of his favorite techniques is called shifting the ground. So if a reporter asks him about the negative effects of his new construction project will have on the neighborhood, Trump doesn't argue that the negatives will be small. Instead, he talks about all the jobs and other positive effects his building will bring. This technique helps him transform a negative question into a positive answer. So it's not about debating the question directly or whatever he was accused of, but rather talking about something related to the question that is actually positive. And that requires smoothly shifting the focus of attention. And by the way, he openly talks about this technique and a lot of his other techniques for negotiation in his book, The Art of the Deal, for which we have a summary at growth.me. I definitely recommend checking out that summary too. Asking specific questions is another powerful way of focusing people's attention exactly where you want it. Through carefully planned questions, someone's attention can be redirected in a specific new direction. In one Canadian study, people were asked one of two questions. They were either asked, "Are you happy with your social life?" or they were asked, Are you unhappy with your social life? These questions sound almost identical, but here's the shocker. The people asked if they were unhappy were 375% more likely to say they were. What the heck is going on here? Well, Cialdini says these two questions create very different, what he calls, attention tunnels. You see, when someone is asked if they are unhappy with their social life, that word unhappy makes them search their mind for all their recent unhappy memories. And because that's what they're searching for, that's what they find. They remember the moments they felt lonely. But when someone is asked, are you happy with your social life? Well, then people search their mind for recent happy memories. Even if there were only a few happy social experiences recently, well, that's what they're looking for, and those are the memories that arise at that moment. And this little change in how the question is asked totally changes what people are remembering at that moment and totally changes how they answer the question. And that's why the people asked if they are unhappy with their social life were 375% more likely to say they were. In fact, Cialdini says this is a big problem with many polls and surveys. If someone asks people, are you happy with the president, they will get a very different answer than someone who asks, are you unhappy with the president? The way the question is asked will change what people are focused on at that moment and how they respond. In another study, scientists were asking people to fill out a survey in a shopping mall, and they found that 29% of random people would agree to fill out this survey. Well, that's not bad. It's quite a few people. But then the scientists tried a social experiment. Before asking someone to fill out the survey, they first asked, are you a helpful person? And after asking this question, 77.3% of people agreed to fill out the survey. That's from 29% to 77%. That is huge, more than double the number of people saying yes. Well, what's going on there? While most of us believe that we are nice and helpful people, we don't really always have time to stop and help everyone who hassles us in the mall. However, if someone asks you if you consider yourself a helpful person and you say yes, well, then right after it would feel pretty weird to refuse to help them with their survey, right? And this is a great example of persuasion. This little question asked before a following request shifts a person's attention, so they are a lot more likely to say yes to that next request. So, a summary of this lesson: our attention is limited. When we pay attention to one thing, we are forced to ignore everything else. And this means asking questions can be a powerful way to prepare the ground for a request. For example, if a researcher asks, are you a helpful person? Then a person becomes twice as likely to help fill out a survey right after. And now we have lesson four. Grab people's attention most effectively with sex, danger, and novelty. Based on his research in science and biology, Professor Cialdini says people's attention is attracted most by cues related to sex, danger, and anything that looks new or different. Let's look at these one by one. So first is sex. Sexual cues get people's attention, and most of us understand this right away because we see how it works in our daily lives, especially in the context of, let's say, dating. Well, advertising and media pros also understand this, and they deliberately take advantage of our reproductive wiring. That's why magazines often show half-naked airbrushed people on the cover. Advertisements deliberately use models. Well, models are people who look more attractive than average, almost by definition. As a result, we can't help but look at these advertisements and magazine covers, and while we're looking, we also, on the way, notice their headlines and products also. As the old advertising saying goes, sex sells. Studies show that using sex to grab attention is especially effective when selling something that helps someone be more attractive or find a mate, and this includes cologne, stylish clothes, sports cars, and so on. Using it as an attention grabber for random products like bread is not as effective, which makes sense. Okay, next we have danger. The deepest instinct of any animal is to survive. This means our human brains are wired with physical survival as the number one priority. This is how your ancestors over the past millions of years were able to survive, even while being hunted by tigers in the African grasslands, because they were always on the lookout for danger. And that's why news of danger or threat is such an attention magnet. Your brain wants to keep a close eye on anything dangerous so it can't kill you. The big corporations which produce the news understand this very well, so they often report on violence and disasters ad nauseum, even if they're happening on the other side of the world and barely relevant to most of their viewers' lives. Here's what Cialdini writes about this. Quote, "Certain cues seize our attention vigorously. Those that do so most powerfully are linked to our survival. Sexual and violent stimuli are primary examples because of their connections to our fundamental motivations to reproduce on the one hand, and to avoid harm on the other, life and death, literally." End quote. Cigarettes became popular because of powerful marketing. Big companies used icons like the rugged cowboy Marlboro Man to make people associate sticks of tobacco with masculinity and strength. Later, Edward Bernays designed a propaganda campaign to make women smoke by labeling cigarettes as feminist torches of freedom. And if you want to learn more about the psychology behind these ad campaigns in detail, then look at our summaries of the books Contagious by Jonah Berger, which talks about the Marlboro Man ads, and Propaganda by Edward Bernays. It's really fascinating stuff, and you can find those book summaries at growth.me. Okay, but then the number of smokers dropped dramatically since 1950. So what happened? Well, people became aware of the dangers of smoking for themselves and the dangers for their kids. And just as advertising was used to sell cigarettes, later many governments and nonprofits used advertising to make people aware of the dangers. For example, now when you buy a cigarette pack in many countries, you will see a gross black lung on the package. According to Cialdini, studies show that just scaring people doesn't work. But if you first scare people a bit and then show them practical steps for how to avoid the danger, well, then you can persuade them to change their behavior. Even if you have a small business, you can tap into some of this psychology of danger or threat to grow your business faster. For example, if you're a personal gym trainer, you could explain to potential clients that belly fat is not just unattractive, but actually deadly. Okay, now we have the last one. Grabbing attention with the new or the different. All animals instinctively want to go and investigate when there is something new or different in their environment. For example, if you hear something rustling under your bed that might be a bug, then you're obviously going to know what that is, right? Another example, when you walk into a home with a dog, the dog will always run over to sniff you. In science, this is called the investigative reflex. It probably exists in our brains so that we can go make sure the new thing is not dangerous. So if you want to grab attention, you should think about how you can be new, different, and unexpected to the people whose attention you want to grab. Professor Jonah Berger, who wrote the great book Contagious, says, quote, "One way to generate surprise is by breaking a pattern people have come to expect," end quote. And that means you should consider what people are expecting to see or expecting to happen, and then break that expectation by doing something different. Comedians are often geniuses at doing this. Well, here's an example for, let's say, business. Imagine you're an accountant sending out a sales letter to 100 local businesses that you want them to hire you. And the reality is that most people hate junk mail and will often put anything that looks like advertising right into their trash can. So how do you grab their attention and at least open your letter? Well, there's a cool technique called lumpy mail, which I first heard from the marketing expert Dan Kennedy. And from sending hundreds of thousands of sales letters, Dan Kennedy found that adding a small object inside the letter greatly increases the sales. You see, when people open the envelope, they can feel there's something inside the letter and they become curious. So they open the envelope, they find some little object inside, and then they start reading the letter to find out what is this all about. So, for example, an accountant could add a small toy calculator inside each letter. It's a small added cost, but it could easily pay for itself by just having a few new clients with a lot more people opening the letters and actually reading the advertising. All right, so a summary of this lesson. People are wired to pay attention to cues related to sex, danger, and the new or different. That's why ads, movies, and other media use attractive models. That's why the news is always showing disasters, even if they happen on the other side of the world. We can also use these appeals to grab attention for our own projects. For example, by showing how your product can help people stay safe and healthy. And now lesson 5, hold people's attention by making it all about them. If you want to be a successful persuader, then you not only have to grab people's attention, but you also have to keep their attention. If you can't hold people's attention, then they'll never hear your full proposal, sales pitch, or video. For example, if you want to be a YouTuber, then you need people watching your whole videos, not just the first 5 seconds. Cialdini says the solution is simple. If you want to hold someone's attention, then make your message all about them. After all, the most interesting thing in the world to most people is themselves. So if you want to hold attention, then talk about their interests, their problems, and their worries instead of talking about yourself or your company. As the classic self-help author Dale Carnegie said, quote, "You can make more friends in 2 months by becoming interested in other people than you can in 2 years by trying to get other people interested in you," end quote. Advertising studies found that adding the word you into an ad increases its effectiveness tremendously. So keep this in mind next time you're speaking with someone, putting together a presentation, or publishing some content online. Don't use too many impersonal words like people or they. Instead, use the word you, and people will feel you're speaking directly to them. Another effective technique is to mention some personal detail about your target audience, like their age, their sex, or another personal characteristic. Have you ever heard those ads on the radio that start with a sentence like, "Attention men over 40, you want to lose at least 15 pounds." Well, they start like that because it works. It's far more effective than an ad that's all about me, 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 like, Dr. So-and-so has been helping individuals decrease their BMI for over 10 years since he received his PhD from this university. So I hope you get the point here. Summary of this lesson, hold people's attention by using the word you often and always talking in terms of their interests, concerns, or problems. Now we have lesson 6. Hold people's attention also by telling unfinished stories and mysteries. Ever noticed how so many popular TV series, they end each episode on a cliffhanger? For example, in the last minute, the main character suddenly has a gun pointed at their head. And if you want to find out what happens next, if they stay alive, then you'll have to tune in next week. Well, why do they do that to us? Because it works, obviously. Scientists have found that unfinished stories or tasks are remembered, while finished ones are quickly forgotten. The scientific word for this is the Zeigarnik effect. People have a strong desire for closure. We don't like unfinished stories, unanswered questions, and unresolved problems. It bothers us when something is left unfinished. Yet, as soon as we do get that closure about something, then we tend to forget about it quickly and move on. So, if you want to hold someone's attention, don't give them closure right away. For example, many professional public speakers start their speech with a story, but then they don't finish the story right away. Instead, they switch to talking about something else. And people are hooked. They want to hear the end of the interesting story, so they keep listening intently. And then finally, near the end of the speech, that speaker goes back and completes the story, and the audience finally gets closure and they can relax. When Professor Robert Cialdini was writing his first book, he wanted to understand what made some popular science books so interesting and engaging to the general public. So he went and read many of the best-selling science books, carefully deconstructing why certain sections were fascinating. And what he found was that the best science writers were actually mystery writers. They first described some kind of mystery, and then they slowly unfolded the scientific explanation for the mystery. And this technique pulls people into the book because they want to know the solution to the mystery. So, a summary of this lesson: leaving a story unfinished or telling a mystery is a very good technique at holding attention. People will stay focused on you because they want to know how the story or mystery will finally be resolved. Scientific term for this is the Zeigarnik effect. And now lesson 7. Share a common identity with someone and you can influence them powerfully. In Cialdini's first breakthrough book called Influence, he described 6 influence triggers, and he says if he was writing that book today, he would have included a 7th trigger called unity. Unity is when someone feels you are one of them. Unity is about shared groups, shared identities, and shared worldviews. Here's a quote: "It's about the categories that individuals use to define themselves and their groups, such as race, ethnicity, nationality, and family, as well as political and religious affiliations. A key characteristic of these categories is that their members tend to feel at one with, merged with, the others. They are categories in which the conduct of one member influences the self-esteem of other members. Put simply, we is the shared me." End quote. A sure sign of unity is when people use the words we and us. Religious people don't say the church or the temple, they say our church. Fanatical sports fans don't say the sports team won, they say we won or we lost. Eric Hoffer wrote an incredible book called The True Believer that demystified why people join those large movements like communism, Nazism, fascism, or nationalism. And he said, quote, "The desire to belong is partly a desire to lose oneself," end quote. People want to feel part of something bigger and more powerful than their fragile individual selves. And by the way, we have a summary of The True Believer on growth.me that you can go and listen to next. So we usually feel most unified with our families. This is part of biology. You see, while we all may have friends that we have a lot more in common with than our families, I bet that most people would be more willing to donate a kidney or risk our lives for our family. Scientists have even measured that when you're helping out a family member, part of your brain actually feels like you're selfishly helping yourself. And by one way of looking at it, you are helping yourself, or at least your genes, because we shared a lot of genes in common with family. The evolutionary biologist Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The Selfish Gene, which talks a lot about this. Now, some groups have smartly figured out that you can create feelings of unity between people by using words and language associated with family. Here's a quote: "Collectives that create a sense of we-ness among their members are characterized by the use of familial images and labels. Brothers, sisterhood, forefathers, motherland, heritage," end quote. Another way to engineer feelings of unity is by making people act and move together. Studies found people dancing or singing together feel more at one with each other. One study found that young children who danced with each other later became more generous about sharing toys. This is probably why so many cultures have some type of tribal or cultural dancing. This is also maybe the reason why every army has soldiers marching together and often chanting. These collective actions create a sense of unity, making the soldiers maybe more selfless in future battles. Summary of this lesson: when people feel you are one of them, then you can influence them more powerfully. This means you are both of the same family, group, or tribe. Some groups use language related to family to encourage these feelings of unity, like saying brothers in arms, for example. Other groups use collective actions like dancing or singing together to promote this unity. Now we have lesson 8. Engineer new mental connections to secretly influence people's choices. So, all of the thoughts, memories, and ideas in your brain are interconnected. This means no thought exists on its own. These connections happen organically for most of the time. But recently, some people have figured out that these connections can actually be engineered in people's minds. So I'm sure you've heard of the famous experiment of Pavlov's dogs. There was a scientist named Pavlov who rang a bell every time he gave his dogs food, and later he noticed that when he rang the bell, the dogs would already start to drool and salivate just at the sound. You see, Pavlov had created a new mental connection in his dogs' minds. He linked the bell sound to food so that now every time he rang the bell, the dogs were instantly reminded of the food. Well, this is what branding is all about: creating a connection between some company and or product and positive feelings. So big marketers have basically turned us into Pavlov's dogs. For example, what do you think of when you hear the word Gucci? I think of rich people. How about the car company Mercedes-Benz? I think of luxury. How about Apple? Oh, I think of creativity or being different. And chances are your answers were probably pretty similar, right? Now, these associations are not by accident. They were carefully engineered by the best business people and marketers in the world. Here's how Cialdini talks about this. Quote, "Advertisers have been using the tactic for more than a century. They present something that attracts their target audience, a beautiful vista, a good-looking model, a popular celebrity, and then link it to the product through nothing more than a simultaneous presence inside the ad." End quote. The power these mental associations have over us can be totally hidden from us. For example, in one scientific study, it was done in a wine store, and they wanted to see if the music in the store had any effect on sales. And what they found was very interesting. On days when the wine store played classical German music, sales of German wine went up, and on days when they played classical French music, sales of French wine went up. Was very surprising to the researchers, to say the least. A different book, which I mentioned before already, called Contagious, explains how building triggers into your ideas or your products can make people remember them more often. For example, when marketing campaigns successfully turned coffee into a trigger for thinking about Kit Kat chocolate bars. As a result, sales of Kit Kat rose by over 33%. The strategy was to make a common everyday object like coffee into a trigger for the product, and it clearly worked. So every time people thought of coffee, they suddenly thought of Kit Kat bars and they were more likely to eat it. Summary of this lesson: all the thoughts in our brains are linked with connections. New connections can actually be engineered, like how the scientist Pavlov created a new link in his dog's minds between the sound of a bell ringing and food. Branding is based on this idea, and these connections can influence us even when we are unaware of them. And now lesson 9, avoid words which create the wrong mental connections for you. So if everything in your mind is linked together, well then every word you use can spark some old associations in people's minds. This means you should be careful because certain words can have very negative associations. All right, so Cialdini was consulting at an award-winning hospital, a very successful hospital, and he noticed they had strict rules about the words and language they used in the hospital. Now, most people think that these little differences in language don't really matter. However, the management of this hospital was convinced that this was one of the keys to their success. Here's a quote of the hospital's policies from the book. Quote, "As a healthcare organization, we're devoted to acts of healing, so we never use language associated with violence. We don't have bullet points, we have information points, we don't attack a problem, we approach it," end quote. Here's a practical way Cialdini says we can use this new knowledge. So instead of telling customers the cost of something, you can say investment instead. Why? Because the word cost is usually associated with losing money, while investment is associated with gain. There was a scientific study where employees in a call center were instructed to raise money for some cause, and they were given papers with their work instructions. Now, half the workers received papers that included a photo of a runner winning a race on the paper, but the other half of workers didn't include that photo. They didn't see that photo on the instructions. And guess what? The employees who had seen the photo of the winning runner raised 60% more money than the others. Well, scientists believe that this photo raised achievement-related thinking in the callers and caused them to work harder. Right? It's a small cue, a small difference, but perhaps it can make a big difference. And the same effect happens when seeing words associated to winning. Here's a quote. "Multiple studies have shown that subtly exposing individuals to words that connote achievement, like win, attain, succeed, master, increases their performance on the assigned task and more than doubles their willingness to keep working at it," end quote. So I hope it's becoming clear that these small words and changes can make an impact. And if you'll excuse me, I need to go out and buy a big poster with the words achieve and conquer for my wall. So, summary of this lesson, some words in language may have unwanted negative associations, so you'll want to avoid linking your message or your product to those words. Studies prove that exposing yourself to words and images related to success can have a positive effect on your effort. And now we have lesson 10. Make people trust you by mentally linking yourself to those they already trust. So, trust is the most useful idea for people to associate you or your business with. If people trust you, then they'll believe what you're saying a lot more. They may purchase your product and they'll feel safe forming a relationship with you. On the other hand, you absolutely want to avoid people associating you with dishonesty, lying, and cheating. Cialdini learned a sneaky trick for building an association of trust from a home alarm salesman named Jim. So Jim claimed that this simple technique allowed potential customers to trust him and made him the top salesperson in his company. So here's what happened. Jim would enter the home of a family interested in buying an alarm system, and he would start by asking the family to complete a test about home safety. And then every time, he would do the same thing next. Here's a quote. He'd slap his forehead and say, "Oh, I forgot some really important information in my car, and I need to get it. I don't want to interrupt the test, so would you mind if I let myself out and back into your home?" The answer was always some form of, "Sure, go ahead." Oftentimes, it required giving him a door key, end quote. So with every single family, Jim repeated this technique of pretending to accidentally forget something. And Cialdini, who was following this guy for research, he finally asked him, why was he doing this routine every time? And Jim replied, quote, "Think, Bob, who do you let walk in and out of your house on their own? Only someone you trust, right? I want to be associated with trust in those families' minds," end quote. All right, so Jim didn't ask the families to trust me directly. That would obviously not be effective. Instead, he had the families treat him like a person they already trust by allowing him to leave and enter their home on his own. That's pretty clever, right? So, summary of this lesson, trust is a very useful feeling for people to associate you with. As Jim's story demonstrated, sometimes you can create an association of trust by making people treat you like someone they already trust. All right, so now a quick conclusion. As a very fast recap of this book, the next time you're trying to persuade someone, keep these three things especially in mind: attention, unity, and connections. First is attention. Where do you need to direct someone's attention? What specific question could you ask to guide their focus? Next is unity. Are you one of them? How can you show that? And this will allow you to influence someone powerfully. And last is connections. What positive mental connections do you want for yourself or your product? What positive words or images can you bring up? What negative words should you avoid? Professor Cialdini packed a lot of interesting and provocative new ideas in this book. And if you enjoyed this summary, then definitely pick up the full book, because there were a lot of interesting stories and tips that we just didn't have time to cover here. Also, Cialdini's first book called Influence, that is a must read if you're at all interested in marketing or psychology. And keep an eye out, because we'll be doing a note on that book in the future too.